And a welcome to you, good humans, to the Nerdist Podcast number 401. I'll be performing stand-up comedy a bit this fall, as soon as September 11th through the 14th at Cobb's in San Francisco. Also September 27th at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, and November 8th at the Carolina Theater in Durham, North Carolina. And I'm working on rescheduling shows like the ones in Minneapolis that I had to miss. Cause of work. I work a lot, you guys. So I need to move some work out of the way so I can go do more work. But I'm excited to get back out on the road and do a bunch more stand-up. So come out and say hi. There's always hugs and high fives afterwards. But really come out to the San Francisco shows if you're in that region at all, because I'm performing at Cobb's. And that's a big damn place. I'm doing like 5 shows there. So come by nerdist.com/calendar to get info and tickets on that stuff. Attention Futurama fans. The last episode of Futurama is September 4th on Comedy Central, and I know you're going to be brokenhearted about this. A lot of good stuff is ending this year, but we have partnered, we as a Nerdist have partnered with Comedy Central, and we're doing a live stream Q&A with a bunch of people from Futurama, like Matt Groening and David X. Cohen and Maurice LaMarche and some other cast members will be announcing in the next couple of days. But pretty much everyone. Or most everyone. So you will definitely... We actually are giving away tickets to 100 people to come out and see that live when we do it at the YouTube space in Los Angeles. I think that might be full. But if you go to Nerdist.com, you can get information on that. And the live stream, we're doing a Q&A before the last episode. And then another little wrap-up chat after the episode. So before and after, we'll surround it with try to surround it with as many goodbye hugs as possible. And I mean, who knows? You know, Futurama keeps coming back. So you know, we don't have to say that it's necessarily going to be gone forever. But this is the series finale in this iteration, and hopefully someday we'll get it back. But until then, you have us at Nerdist to live stream this event for you on Wednesday, September 4th. This episode is another band that I adore that really, again, I've said this a lot, but I kind of feel like at this point we're cheating the system and that the podcast is just a way for us to sneakily meet people that we want to meet and be like, oh, by the way, can we record this conversation? It's funny, if we just said, hey, can we meet a bunch of bands that we like? People would probably go, why don't you go to hell? Try that. But we go, hey, we'd like to meet bands. We'll bring recording equipment. And then they keep saying yes. So that's the sneaky trick you got to do if you want to meet people you want to meet, is just bring recording equipment. But I love The National. And this is just Matt Berninger from The National, who's the vocalist and writes a lot of songs. And he's a swell dude who had us into his home to record this, so we didn't come to Meltdown. We infiltrated his domicile and interrogated him for an hour, and he was great. Their new album is called Trouble Will Find Me, and it's out, so you should buy it and stuff it into your ears as quickly as you possibly can. And here we go, Nerdist Podcast episode number 401 with Matt Berninger of The National.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
How's my hair?
It looks good for this audio podcast.
Good.
It looks fantastic.
Can you hear it?
You can hear it. Just
you
like
try smell. Different hairstyles for different songs on your album.
Are we recording?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are now. Can you hear my hair? I do.
Even your hair sounds good.
My hair doesn't do any styles. It's this way or that way. That's kind of the only thing it does.
Was there ever any point where you're like, the band should look like this, or are you like, it doesn't matter? Or then did you start
mostly
worrying
it's like,
about it?
Why does the band look like this? No, but there was when we did start, there was a you know, the Interpol and the Strokes just looked so awesome, and we attempted to like, well, what should we look like? You know, we need to look we need to do something. And we took a photo where we were all like in t-shirts in a field. I don't know what we were going for. I had like a low V-neck. Remember there was a short time where they, even for men, they were making these really low cut sort of V-neck.
Oh yeah, that's called American Apparel. They still do it.
Yeah, like a level 12.
Something. I thought that might be an interesting idea. I have no idea what we're thinking, but it was, we looked so terrible and weird and just the opposite of sexy. I'm not sure what that is. Like, so that was the last time we attempted to like try something. And then a few years ago, I just started wearing suits, like on stage, and 'cause I realized that is just, you know, has the least amount.
You cannot go wrong.
Yeah, the least amount can go wrong with that.
Yeah.
And as I get older, I won't look silly in like, you know, my cutoffs and V-neck shirts, my cutoff short pants, we're not going to look good, you know.
Yeah, like the Beatles never look back at their 64, 65 period and go, we looked ridiculous. But if they look at Magical Mystery Tour, they must now think. Well the two that are alive. We looked ridiculous.
When they kind of went off on their own, like, it was so interesting to see the evolution of, we're all the same unit, and now our unit is, we're all unique and individual. I think it was very much a product of the late 60s of, like, individuality, and I'm the denim guy, and I'm the cute one with the suit. And
my favorite thing is when they went back to, they're all doing the Amish, like, the big black hats, like,
yes,
big long beards, and black, like, black coats. What was that? I think that's right.
That was Abbey Road.
I don't think George Harrison ever got out of that. I think he just, think he just stayed there.
No, that was one of the coolest looks.
George was the best Beatle. Let's all agree.
He was pretty great.
Thank you. I've become, as time goes by, a Ringo fan. There's something about
Have you
Ringo.
Been to the Grammy
I
Museum?
Have.
I went as well.
I have.
With Tony Thaxton.
I bought a t-shirt.
Did you buy the one of him in the spacesuit?
Yeah.
I bought the only one
they have for men.
I had to buy that.
I wanted the one with the sparkly, the sparkle jewels that says Ringo on it. But they didn't have it for men. So I bought it for my wife. And then it was too small for her. So now my daughter, I put my daughter in
that's
it.
That's fantastic. Yeah. No, but that'd be, if those listening, there's a Grammy Museum in Los Angeles, and there's a change-out exhibit they do all the time, and right now it's Ringo. So it's just
Ringo
Starr exhibit.
Ringo.
But they have like his drum kit, they have like his Let It Be outfit, they have his one of his suits from like a 65 tour.
Well, our friend Liam Lynch is friends with Ringo.
Yeah,
and he says he's awesome.
Yeah,
and sure just tells like the best stories, and he's a sweet guy. And
we should get him on the podcast.
I think he might do it.
Matt, is there some sort of musical number you could call where you can just get a Beatle on the phone?
Where's the music hotline?
Ringo, yeah, like, people in bands all can talk to Ringo.
Someone should cover like it's like. Okay, I get it. You know, yeah, you could cover Hey Jude, or you could cover Imagine, but no one has covered. You're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine. Like, someone should cover, like a Ringo. Yeah, yeah. Has there been, like, a Ringo tribute album?
I don't know.
I'm sure there can
How many of the Beatles songs were his? I mean, there's
Octopus's Garden.
That one's the big one. There's a handful. There's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
You could do that thing that, like, Sun Kil Moon does, cover an entire album, and just, like, it's just the Ringo. The National covers Ringo.
Yeah.
Don't even kickstart it. I'll give you the money.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to do that.
Do you want to just pool the cash that we have now? To do it?
Yeah, I mean, I have
like $80.
Like
is that enough to do a Ringo album?
It should be. One would think. No, but it's hard. We were just, we went on right before Paul McCartney at a festival just a couple weeks ago, Outside Land Festival.
Oh, and, which is amazing.
Yeah, beautiful. This happens not just with Paul McCartney, but like every big headline, even like when Dylan... You know, Dylan's headlining a festival, or it happened when we were some place where Prince was headlining, or another place even Tom Petty. But they shut down. It's like they shut down everything for like the 15 minutes before they're supposed to go on. It's actually longer than that. It's like half an hour, and like you cannot you could be a mile away from the stage where. You know, whoever it is arriving in a black tinted vehicle, and they will shut down even over there. You can't go through gates, and it's complete lockdown. And so that happened at Outside Lands when Paul McCartney came through, and so none of us were able, none of us, I can't even remember where I was when lockdown happened, but apparently all of our crew who were taking down all of our stuff, you know, and putting all of our stuff in the cases and stuff, were still on the stage, and when it came lockdown, even they had to just stand still while McCartney came through the area, came up to the stage and everything. Just like people weren't even allowed to walk around. It's just like what happened, but. They say like he walked. There's like four of our guys in our crew standing there and just all sweaty and like just and all of a sudden he walks right past them and he just looks at all four of them and goes, "Looking good, boys." And they're just and you can't even respond. You're just supposed to stand there and like they just smiled and gave him the thumbs up. But anyway, I thought that was nice.
Outside Lands is a great festival, which I think is not as popular as its sister festival, Bonnaroo. I shouldn't say popular. It's just not as well known. Like, people ever go, Bonnaroo, and then you go Outside Lands, and they go, where's that?
Oh, it's in San Francisco. I didn't realize those were brothers and sisters.
Yeah, they're sister festivals.
How does that work? Does it mean the same promoter, the same...
I believe it's the same... I believe it's the same team that does Bonnaroo, produces...
Why do they always think Jack Johnson started Bonnaroo?
I don't know.
Did I make that up in my head?
I don't know.
You thought that up. Jack Johnson did? I don't know.
I don't know why I would think that. I don't know where in my brain that
Jack Johnson's a brand of jazzmatazz, I like to call it.
All he needs is a Taylor guitar, no shoes. That guy just goes for it.
How was...
Hacky sack.
Is there any part of you guys that's like, oh, fuck, Paul McCartney's probably watching this. Does that not bother you at all or get in your head or do you...
Paul McCartney's watching what?
You guys. If you go on before him, there's
no, he's got lockdown. Us. He's got lockdown. He doesn't need
he
to
wasn't
be
watching. Although he did say this is what we heard and is that when we played Outside Lands, Kronos Quartet played with us. Beautiful. They also played with Paul McCartney afterwards and doing all the strings for the songs that he was doing. Kronos Quartet told us that they talked with Paul McCartney for a while, and apparently he kept asking them questions about the National. He's like, you play with the National? I love the National. So, yeah, that's what we heard secondhand from Kronos Quartet. Although those guys are a bunch of liars.
Seriously.
No.
And they all talk at the same time, but in different ranges.
Different. I like that line.
You are the National. You like the National. I like the National. Like,
they were wonderful, amazing people, the Kronos Quartet. Total badasses and party like pigs too. No,
I want that to be true.
They were cool. And we also Bob Weir joined us on stage for that.
Oh yeah, I read about that. Yeah,
it was fun. Anyway,
that's really cool. Yeah, so because Outside Lands has a comedy tent effectively, and I performed in it last year. Yeah, it says Bonnaroo, and so I didn't really get to see the rest of the festival because I was performing all day, but I think last year it was, you know, Metallica and Skrillex, and I mean, it really is like the biggest people at, you know, playing at the festivals.
Yeah, it's a cool festival.
Do you like doing festivals, or would you rather, or is it just like, well, this is just sort of a, because I know if you're a comedian, if you do a festival, it does kind of kill that city for you for a while. You can't really go back and play there again anytime soon.
Yeah, no, it's everywhere you go. It's like if you're going to do the big festival that's in town, they have exclusivity. You know, it makes sense. It's just because you also, you know, you can't play a big show at, say, you know, the Hollywood Bowl and then book another show at the Greek or something like that.
Right.
They know the markets and everything. So, but it's it depends. So we have been doing a balance of those things, you know, festivals and then our own like theater shows, and they're both really cool and often very different ways. You know, we don't do anything drastically different. I definitely don't. I just drink wine, close my eyes, and get into the songs, whether it's in a little bar or a beautiful theater or a big outdoor festival. I kind of get kind of drunk and stomp around like a crazy man and, you know, wherever we are. But what I prefer, I guess, I think everything seems to click best inside a little small room somehow, you know. Even I think like even the indoor standing places are the best for us or whatever. Although I'm a big fan of seeing shows, seated theater shows, and because you have the option to sit down for just a song or two if you're back is freaking out or whatever. And
well, I think from the artist's point of view, though, if you're in an intimate venue, if you're standing on stage, you can feel everyone in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And so I imagine that, you know, where it's like a big outdoor festival, where it's like, oh, it just goes thousands of people back and they're on the room, that the people in the back are probably enjoying it just as much as people in a venue, but you as a performer can't feel them at all. Like it just, everything just kind of sails out into space.
Yeah, it is a little harder. It's true. I mean, one of the reasons why I've, over the past tour or so, and I started doing it touring for our last record, I started going out into the audience and climbing off the stages and kind of going out into the crowds, and is to connect that thing between the stage and the mass of people and stuff, and to sort of break down that wall. And I love it. And that's one thing that I think is a way that I've found to sort of get a closer, more direct link to the electricity of that group of a mass of people like that. And in some places, the big outdoor festivals, sometimes it can be a little dangerous because you got whatever, tens of thousands of people, you know, crushing in and squeezing in. I think now they've designed festivals better that those big dangerous crushes of bodies move, they have barriers so that can't happen, like some of the dangerous things that
happen. So you stage dive and then you hit someone in the face with a glass of wine or a bottle?
No, I've never hit anybody in the face with a glass of anything that I can remember.
Sebastian Bach.
It's usually a solo cup. I smash people in the face with a solo cup.
Oh, it's a festival. You hit him in the face with a solo cup.
Yeah.
Boy, the National, man, people get really just beat the shit out of each other.
I did. I had a relatively full solo cup of wine, and I flipped it into the air, and usually it'll tumble, and all the wine will splash out. But I could tell this one was just kind of going, and it was staying in this perfect upright position through the air, and it was full of wine. It was like a big cup of wine, and I saw it coming down. I was like, oh, that's gonna be that's gonna hurt, you know. And I could see people that like were kind of looking and weren't looking, and it came smack down on. Luckily, a dude. I don't know why it was better that it was a dude than him.
It was way better that it was a dude.
Right on top of his head and exploded. He seemed to love it, but I've stopped throwing things into the crowd.
I guess it does. Yeah,
red wine or white wine?
This is white wine.
Okay. So he was totally fine.
I drink both flavors though.
Have you ever been on stage and you felt like, oh, everyone's into this. I totally have a crowd, and then you kind of do something to where you're fucking around, and then you're like, shit, I think I just lost everyone. Do you have that, or are you going to go, well, that's why you have music, because then you can all automatically pull everyone back in?
Yeah, well, mostly like, we've gotten better, but we're not good banter. We're not a good banter band. We've never thought of ourselves as a good banter band. So occasionally you'll be in between songs, you'll think you're like, oh, this'll you know, be a funny quip, you know, or whatever, and when one of those things is lands flat, it does you know, the energy and the electricity suddenly just disappears for a second, and that's when we pray for the drum beat to kick in.
There's always that thing though where like a musician will say something on stage and the crowd will react as though they were Louis C.K. doing his closer.
Right,
and I just turn and go, it wasn't
right.
Funny.
No,
yeah.
People have been overly generous with their laughter at our crappy banter. For sure.
I think it has a lot to do with the tone of the band and the type of audience that's there. And I think, you know, if the music is like contemplative and it's soulful and people are really, you know, that there's a groove that they kind of get into on it, that just contextually their brains just aren't in the right place. You know, their brains are just not in the right place. And in any other situation, they might have been like, oh, that's really funny. But, you know, it's sometimes I think it's hard to kick them out of that. That's why it's, you know, like it can be really shitty as a comic to open for a band.
Yeah.
It depends on what the band is. But I think if the energy just is, it's just like one thing too many for an audience to be able to be like, oh, now I'm in this mode.
Well, I think with us, actually, we have our songs are melodramatic, and they are most of them are tense, and sometimes some of them are dark and sad.
You just described the Kronos Quartet.
But, are you saying the song "Sorrow" is sad and intense?
But I think in live, when we're playing a bunch of these songs in a row, it's when in between some songs we take a break and say something like make a penis joke or something like that, it actually relieves a lot of the tension in the room. And I think it's a good, like, I think the audience kind of, our audience actually reacts well to that. Is like the kind of taking a piss on ourselves or a little bit out of ourselves.
They want to know you're fun.
We don't piss on ourselves. I said that wrong. But
so you guys all pee on each other ritualistically before each show.
Yeah, between every song we pee on each other. But
that's not white wine.
But I think it does. It is a good tension release, and otherwise you get 2 hours of dark intensity with our songs, and I think that could be too much. So I don't know if I could listen to like 2 hours of us in some of these songs.
Do you ever listen back on some of your songs? You go, Jesus Christ, what was I going through at that time?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of times I like, wow, that was, there's a song Available, which is a much, much older song, but it's like, I listened to that, I was like, wow, I was mad. You know, I was an angry, angry man at that point. I can't remember what I was so angry about, but, sometimes they're funny to look back and
are there any songs that people just totally miss? Is there a song that's supposed to be more ironic, but people take it literally? Like, is there anything where you... Because obviously, once you write something, put it out in the world, it's kind of not yours anymore. Like, everyone attaches what they want to it.
I like when people attach whatever they want to it. And I don't use a lot of irony. The songs are there's silly moments and stuff, but they're not like irony is not what it would be. But I mean, I'm like, I dig into the stuff, and I'm some sincere about it. You know, the ugly stuff and the dark stuff and the weird self-deprecating silliness of it all is like, it's never wink wink too much, really. It's I don't know. It's just a weird combination of the mess inside our brains, and I'm not too guarded about what goes into a song, but I think sometimes people often think like, oh, this is a metaphor that it has a specific meaning, and they're all trying to figure out the meanings of songs, like as if they're these enigmas, these riddles or whatever. And most of the time, that's not the case. There isn't a secret meaning that I know what that line means. And everybody's, it's the blurry lines that don't quite mean anything specific are approximations of a feeling or an idea, and I think that's often as close as you can get to the truth is a blurry approximation of it. So some of our blurry, obtuse lyrics aren't obtuse with the purpose of being, you know, clever or hidden. You know, they're not these, like I said, they're not puzzles. They are just, that's about as close as you can get to, you know, an expression of love, you know, whether, because it's a combination, love's a combination of fear and lust and neediness and all these, and ego, all these things, like when you say love, you know. So if it's a line in a love song, it's usually a combination of a bunch of weird blurry emotions and thoughts. So
but I do you ever get the experience of like, so you write an album, or you write and you record, and you're not really paying attention to the, maybe you do, but you're not necessarily paying attention to the overall arc of what everything is, but then you hear everything together and you go, oh my God, I didn't realize it, but yeah. I guess my brain was trying to express this thing. Yeah. I just didn't realize it in the moment.
Well, this record, that happened more so than our other records, in the fact that listening to the songs that they're coming together for Trouble Will Find Me, death kept, like I was coming, I was like, oh, there's another death reference in another song that is all part of this collection. And in fact, there were three or four other ones that I was working on that were also bumped up against the idea of mortality and existence and the ultimate, you know, non-existence, and all those things in different ways. So yeah, death was a big theme on Trouble Will Find Me in several different ways. It wasn't like all coming back to the same point. It was definitely, there's some songs that are funny, you know, ruminations on death, some that are more philosophical on what does it mean to be alive and conscious versus not, and what is afterlife, you know, and all these things that were in the back of my head and were coming out in fragments of lines and lyrics. And so, yeah, that's what happened with this one.
I mean, for most people, they listen to it, like, oh, this music's really great, and I really kind of dig, you know, what they're saying, whatever. But you always sort of forget about the artist where you go, no, this is actually a living diary of whatever this person was going through at the time, which in a way is kind of exposes you.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm a writer, so to say it's a diary would not be quite right, but it is things that are swimming around in the soup of my heart and brain come out in weird ways in my writing, but the writing isn't an attempt for me to express all the details of my inner life or anything like that, or to get it down like a diary might be. Diary is something like, this is what I'm going through right now. The songs are abstract, some abstract, you know, stories and thoughts and collections of imagery and stuff that are about songs. I'm writing songs and writing beautiful songs or trying to write songs that move me in a lot of ways, but they're not all about me on a detail level at all. They are personal on an emotional level though. But
that, since they're not tied to specific details that people are aware of, then it's a sort of a layer of separation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think like any like writers, short story writers and stuff are writing about themselves through these other, the construct of a short story, or you know, a filmmaker is you know, or a painter is. You know, expressing something about themselves, but through a portrait of a, you know, or you know, of something else.
Are you music first and then lyrics, or is it like, do you just start?
I'm definitely melody first. I mean, what happens, the way it happens for us, it's Aaron or Bryce will send little sketches, little like simple guitar sketches or piano sketches that are very rudimentary and just might have one or two parts, you know, and I will listen to that stuff, and I will start to come up with melodies and sing melodies without. And this has been kind of where I've come to in how I've enjoyed the process more. The past two records, it's been about just listening to that stuff, sitting back and just singing along without thinking at all. And sometimes words come out, but mostly I'm just looking for melodies. Sometimes I'll sing other lyrics or other things from other thing, you know, other people's songs and just looking for different melodies to that, to the music, and trying to find the personality of the song just with melody and music. And then later I will start to like craft lyrics and that's when the hard work of the writing the specific lyrics comes into play. But that's definitely the last, and I would say kind of the three, the least important of the things to me, you know, it's melody and music that make the song, and the lyrics are if they're good, then that's the third leg in the stool, in a way. But good lyrics without good melody, I think, the song isn't going to work. It's going to flop. So
you ever sort of. You're trying to figure it out. Do you ever kind of go, fuck, why can't we just be a party band, you know, where everything is? Do you ever wish that you did another type of music, or is there anything else where you go, oh, I'd be so much simpler if we were just this?
I don't, because we're doing exactly what we find the most that we like to do the most. So So doing what we're doing is the easiest thing for to do. Like, it would be much harder for us to, and we've kind of tried in the past to like, oh, let's try to write a song that's more radio friendly or you know, more accessible or whatever that means, and more instant. Because we've been described as a grower band, and our records are growers, which we interpret as something you're not going to like at first, you know. And so, but
is that what that means? Oh, that's not what I thought. That just sort of meant like that the way that it
It's sort of like word of mouth spreads.
We like to look at the worst possible translation.
That's how I would look at it.
That's how you would look at it.
Exactly what I would think.
Yeah, you're not going to like this until later. Yeah, if you have to keep listening, you might like it later.
If you stumble across it later, and then you.
Eventually, but I think it is something that people think. That's one of the things they like about us, is that the records will, our records, and this is something that we don't consciously work towards it being something that slowly grows on people. That's not. It's just the way our songs. That's the way people just say our albums work on them, and we've done well by that. So we're not trying to change any formulas. But every time we've tried to let's write a radio hit, because there has been pressure from label. Not much. We've got a pretty awesome label, but not much pressure. But there has been some pressure here and there. Like, is there any is there anything? What do you think we could do to to this song to make it a little more XYZ, meaning these factors make it give it a better shot of being a commercial radio.
Make a lot
song.
Of money, basically. They're saying,
yeah, I mean, like, in break, and if you can get a song on commercial radio, it's a whole different ballgame. You know, it's like indie rock, and where we have existed, this little sort of corner of indie rock is a very tiny, tiny place. And if you're able to get it, only takes one song to kind of cross over, and that's. That changes everything. It's a whole different, it's exponentially.
Just need that one song in a T-Mobile commercial.
Well, something like that can do it. That can do it. And because there's a whole, 80% of music listeners have never used the word indie rock or think about indie rock or whatever that means. I think 80% of people just hear what they hear on commercial radio and stuff, and that's the world of music, and they'll never. It's like when Arcade Fire won the Grammy, all these people came out and said, "Who's Arcade Fire?" I was like, wow. It reminded me of how small this little indie rock insular music nerd universe is in regards to the big picture, and I think it was kind of. Arcade Fire, Bon Iver, breaking that ceiling a little bit. I mean, actually, other bands have done it too. REM was an indie college band.
Well, I don't know why I was thinking about this in the shower, but this is just thought. I was just sort of thinking about Mumford & Sons in the shower. Like,
you're not alone.
How'd they get... That's funny. It's like, I mean, it's good, but I don't... I never would have thought, this is going to be like a smash commercial... Right. Hit and cross over and really, because it was very, when I first heard it, it was quite a few years ago, and it sounded like, oh, this is really kind of cool, almost, borderline, there's a little bit of bluegrassy something in it, it's like a little bit of something, and I never would have thought this is going to cross over and be a thing, even though I really liked it, but I wonder if in just the way that radio works now, it's sort of like, if an Arcade Fire or a band like that pops through, it's like, yep, that's just indie rock, all represented by this one band. It's not like the radio stations start playing everyone, right?
Right. I don't know. I think it all goes through phases in terms of like, yeah, Mumford & Sons. Were they a small indie band? They were for a very short time because they broke through that ceiling or broke through that other side almost instantly, didn't they? I mean, like, quickly.
I guess I just put them in the same. I remember listening to Mumford
& Sons. And so did Arcade Fire. Well, sort of. No, maybe not as fast.
I just remember listening to them at the same. It was the same year that I listened to like Midlake and Decemberists and like all these bands that I for the longest time just started calling frontier rock because it just sounded like, oh, this is like sort of an anachronistic, kind of 19th century ideal in music.
And why was it of those three that you just mentioned? Why was it Mumford & Sons? Like all three of those bands you mentioned are great, amazing bands, but why was it Mumford & Sons became a humongous band?
America Likes Family.
Yeah. Is that what it is?
So like, oh, and Sons is obviously a family business.
The Sons. Oh, wait, someone, they brought their kids up there? No, I don't know if they're all, I don't think it's a dad and a
it's mostly because they made a great record, and people responded to it. But the Decemberists are a brilliant band that has, when you like talk about the sound, has been doing... writing music in that same kind of universe, but then there's why is it that like the Lumineers and Mumford & Sons I'm not saying all these bands sound the same, but they're in the same kind of
family. They're in the same
color.
Family.
They're in close. Their colors are close in terms of the spectrum of the whole rainbow.
The Spotify engine would probably recommend them.
Right,
to each other.
So what is it about one of the other ones that just? I don't know. I'm not really sure.
He doesn't have any answers, Chris.
I don't have any answers. I can't remember what we're talking about. But we've learned that every time we've made an attempt to, let's see if we can make go for it, or it never helps us write songs. The songs that come out of that motivation or that place have not been songs that we pursue, and they don't end up on the record, because when it comes to us, it's the five of us just listen to the whatever sketches and whatever ideas, the 20-25 songs that are in the mix, and it's the ones that we love the most that last for us, bubble to the top. And even if one of those, like, well, that one was catchy and that could be on the radio, that isn't enough for us to put it on our record. Maybe to our own, our own detriment a little bit, but that's never the way we put records together. But that being said, I will admit that with this record, we're trying to push a couple songs into mainstream commercial radio, just to see if, like, when we just to see, whatever trend we have. I don't know what you call it. Like, you campaign for them, you like push them. Our manager is trying to see if they can get us onto some of that stuff, and she's doing a good job with that. And we support going for it, but it's never helped us write songs.
Just get you on a Zach Braff soundtrack. You'll be good to go.
That's all.
We've been on a lot of
Oh my God. My favorite soundtrack song of yours was from the Portal 2 soundtrack.
Oh yeah.
It was a fucking great game.
Did they actually put out a soundtrack?
Exile and Vilify.
Yeah, that's the song we did. But
You buy, because I have the song, and it says from the game Portal, it says from
Portal. Oh, I didn't know you could
Portal
download
2.
It separately. I thought you had to get to that point in the game to ever hear the song.
It's for sale now.
I should know that.
It's a fact of your account.
Now you know.
I'm so bad at video games. I would never. I haven't been able to listen to the song since we sent it in, because the only place I thought it existed is when you get to that room deep in that game where it's playing on the radio. So
I wonder if they'd mind if I.
I'm not good enough.
I wonder if they would get mad if I tacked it on to the end of the.
Put it on here
into the podcast. If you say it's okay, yeah.
I think it's okay. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that'll stand up in court.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, see? And it says Exile Vilify from the game Portal 2.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, we put that out. I should know. That's our.
This is your band!
We need to recognize the album artwork.
Now that I see the album art, I realize that is a product of ours. Yeah. I should realize that that's available.
But so. it's such a beautiful song, and it's so simple. And when you're writing, when you're making a song like that, do you have to fight the urge to, oh, we should put this section in and we should add this thing? Like, how do you sort of balance out knowing when to streamline, to keep the message, like to empower the song by actually removing a lot, like too many elements?
That is a thing that we, when we're writing and recording stuff, we will throw everything at a song. Any ideas that anybody has about, let's try this on it. Let's see. Let's do it this way. Let's put strings to it, or let's put a brass section to it, or let's go from real drums and marry those with studio weird electronic loops and stuff. Anybody who's got any ideas, we throw it all at the song. But then we have learned to build in plenty of time for us to go back and carve away all the extraneous stuff and pull the song back to its essential elements. Sometimes its essential elements will be a little tiny bits of tons of things, and that makes the weird alchemy of a song. But our songs in the recording and mixing process get ruined and then come back and get ruined again. And so it's a weird constantly like moving target mutation, and sometimes we just have to realize right when the balance of all the stuff is right, and we stop, and we have to like say, all right, that's it. That's as good as that. That's the best version of that song.
That's a hard thing to do.
It's really hard
to be able to go, yep, this is done.
Well, it's really hard to do with one person, and then you have five people plus a producer and, you know, mixer who's got, got creative opinions. That's why for us working, you know, writing and recording and making a record has been in our past a very, and I think it is probably for every band, unless there's somebody who's totally in charge, like, you know, we don't have that person. I'm not in charge. Aaron and Bryce or nobody else is in charge. It's a semi-democratic collective, and that is good for our band, but it also creates, it is hard for us to come together and all agree and be unanimous about which way a song should go, when the song is finished, which songs are worth being on the record and not. And so we fight like animals in the studio, the five of us. And in the past, it's actually gotten to the point where we were afraid of this isn't fun anymore. Or we thought that we can't work together anymore. And that happened more around Boxer, where we thought this might be the end of the band. What was nice is we came out of the Boxer, and then we did it again with High Violet, which was slightly less fraught with tension and fighting. But we got through it both times, and we just realized that's just our process, and it's not going to be, we don't have to fear the end of the band that we'll hate each other so much after all the arguing and the tension of making a record that it'll kill the band. So with this newest record, all that fighting happened and all this, but we weren't worried about the marriage ending.
You have to be comfortable with, like, this is just part of our process. And if that, it's not right. Everything's not on the line. I actually have the National as a Pandora channel. And so I thought it might be kind of fun is, I'm not going to play it on the podcast, but I just want to see what Pandora thinks is in your channel.
I'm
curious to know if you agree.
What other bands are in our channel?
Yeah. So right now it's playing something from Boxer.
Who decides that? Do fans?
A computer.
It's an algorithm.
An algorithm. And it'll actually tell you. So
who's in our algorithm?
It'll actually tell you somewhere on here if I can find the function. But then
every band you say afterwards, I'm going to go, ugh.
Seriously?
Ugh.
Oh, come
they
on.
They suck. Ugh. No, I won't say it, but
I want to find the I wonder if there should be a place on here that'll tell me why it'll tell me why it picked the song and put it on your channel.
Because this guy also sounds like Eeyore. Yeah.
Do you think you sound like Eeyore?
I've been compared to Eeyore a number of times. I've also been compared to Rain Man a few times. I'm not sure what that means, but I think it's more my stage presence.
You seem totally like a chill kind of guy.
Yeah, an un-Rain Man-esque man. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Do you do a lot of counting numbers on stage? That would
no. I walk around and I have weird tics and stuff. And if you Google is Matt Berninger, the top three are is Matt Berninger alcoholic, is Matt Berninger depressed, and is Matt Berninger autistic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Those are the top three Google searches.
Those are the top three, yeah. And then the fourth is Matt Berninger married?
So they want to know more if you have autism than if you're actually in a relationship.
Yeah, something.
And now that you've mentioned this on the podcast, that could kick autism up to number two or one when people are like, oh, now I got to search that to see.
Now I probably, you're right.
Yeah, you probably
did. Did I just do that? Is that how that works?
For yourself.
Who's in my algorithm? Who's in the national algorithm?
We're still a minute and a half away from the end of Start a War.
It won't do anything until then.
So it'll play.
Gotcha.
See, what happens if I skip it right now, then Pandora will think that I don't like this song and then it won't play it again.
Well, don't do that.
But if you can see here, I previously thumbs up this song,
right?
Which means that I do like it. So I don't want that to happen.
Let me ask you though: is it going
to
say what other songs are like the song "Start a War," or is it band based or song based?
I think it's a bit of song and bass, but I can't find now
song and band.
Yeah, song and band bass, but I can't find now that function. Oh, here we go. Well, here are the lyrics. It gives you the lyrics right there. Features of this track: basic rock song structures, folk influence, mixed acoustic and electric instrumentation, extensive vamping is a thing. I like some vamping. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. Major key tonality, acoustic guitar riffs, acoustic rhythm guitars, subtle use of strings, the subtle use of a horn section. These are just a few of the hundreds of attributes cataloged for this track by the Music Genome Project. So I maybe that's user-based. Maybe that's sort of a people saying this is...
I can't wait to see what it says.
This is, yeah, so that's what it says for that one. And then we are 7 seconds away from the next song.
You can't skip ahead?
I don't want to fuck it up. I don't want to fuck up the algorithm.
It'll tell the algorithm that...
Sigur Rós.
Oh, wow.
Came up next.
Huh.
Wir spielen in der Luft. Which...
They're lame. No.
Sigur Worst.
I'm proud to be in the algorithm with those guys.
Yeah, so it threw in there because it said that... acoustic rock instrumentation, subtle use of vocal harmony, mild rhythmic syncopation.
I wonder if
This just makes the music so much fun when you talk Peter about it this way.
I wonder if they go by credits because Peter Kadis, who produced Boxer and mixed that with us, also did some Sigur Rós stuff. So
there may be something to the
or actually
algorithm.
No, it was Jonesy's last solo record that he did stuff. So maybe there's connections behind the scenes there.
Does this? Do you have any? Do you just sit and listen to music, or do you listen to a whole album, or do you listen to like some sort of a randomizer? Like, what's your when you sit and listen?
I put
to music?
Together a playlist about a year and a half ago that has like about 300 songs, and that's the only thing I've been still listening to. And I got to make another playlist, and I got to buy some new music, but. The amount of time I spend with headphones on writing songs and working on songs and listening to our own sketches that those guys are sending me so at the end of the day, like, I turn off everything. I barely watch TV anymore, and I just stare at the fire in the backyard for several hours until my mind falls asleep. But
the next album will be called Staring at the Fire.
Yeah. Staring into flame.
You know, you could just write a song that way. You could just stare at a fire and describe it, and then it would probably be a really awesome song.
I don't know.
Do you ever think about writing literally?
Like, it'd be like
taking
like
a literal situation.
It'd be like yellow, orange, orange,
white,
orange, yellow,
ooh, hot,
yellow,
hot, hot.
Okay.
Spark on pants.
I gotta say, no. I think that would be pretty great. I think that would be kind of cool.
A song about yellow, orange, white.
No, you
hot.
Could
with
you
the right music,
more.
You could absolutely make that work, and people would paint so many things.
Johnny Cash wrote a pretty good fire song.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, in fairness, it wasn't Johnny that wrote it.
All right, who wrote that?
June Carter.
June Carter.
June Carter Cash wrote Ring
You're
of Fire.
Right.
They were together forever.
That's a good.
What kind of what are some of the other songs that are in this 300 playlist? Does it span all of music, or do you feel like it's one kind of sector of?
No, it's a big mix, and it was put together. I call it the Big Sur mix, and it was because my wife and I and a good friend and his wife hadn't spent time together in many, many, many years, and we decided they came out here, we all drove from here up to Big Sur and had a kind of just like, you know, a couple of days up there, and we just
stared at fires
up there, and then up there, and then drove back, and so this mix was just constantly on random and being played, and so it's got India, it's got like Pavement, it's got Air Supply, it's got...
Which one? I'm
Dylan.
All Out of Love?
Yeah. Is that the one? Which one that starts out like, whoop, and then stops and goes, no, it's not All Out of Love.
I might actually... Oh, so third
Every
one,
Woman
Eels.
In the World to me.
Eels.
Eels? Oh, we're in there with the Eels.
Eels cool. Number one. My Timing is Off. It's the number. Is the Eels? Is Eels song?
Realize the best part of life.
Oh, that's Lost in Love.
Lost in Love.
Yeah,
Lost in Love. Yeah, that's what's on there. And then a lot of Roy Orbison, a little Tom Petty, Guided by Voices, some Breeders. So it's a big, big mix of stuff that I love, and you know, Elliott Smith. Yeah.
Do you feel? Do you ever feel like, oh, I should probably, when you say you want to listen to new music, do you want to try to discover new music to sort of fill up whatever it is inside you to be inspired to write in different directions, or do you...
I mean, yeah, I feel like this last record was very influenced by that playlist and very influenced by Roy Orbison for me in particular. Mostly just listening to how he would, his vocal melodies would just go to 10 different places and never go back. And with all within one song, and just, I turn on a dime, and it feels like many of his songs, it feels like, oh, there's a completely new song inside this song. And then it turned, you know, all within the span of 4 minutes. And I was fascinated by what he was doing, melodically. And so while I was singing melodies and coming up with stuff for Trouble Will Find Me, he was always on my mind. He was always on my mind. That's not him. But anyways, that is on my playlist though. But the Pet Shop version, boy.
The Pet Shop Boys version? Yeah,
Pet Shop
Boys. You're always on my mind.
Yeah, I like that one. Anyways, but yeah, so now I feel like I need to stir up the soup with something else and be inspired by some other things.
There is something kind of fun to, because I'm sure most of the time, I mean, since you've written a ton of songs, do you listen to music and you go, yeah, I sort of see what they're, are there any artists where you go, I have no idea how they got from that point to that point and how they tied that all together?
In terms of their like career or just within a song?
No, within a song. Like
I will stay. I mean, everyone talks. I mean, I don't have, but I will be. I like there'll be phases where I don't listen to Radiohead, then I'll put them on and I'm like I'll be sick with, oh, everybody loves Radiohead, and I'll listen to it and like I'll be continually shocked, like, wow, like what the creative moves that are happening within one song here and there with that band are always just blow me away. And you know, they're Radiohead for a reason. Also, I mean, Beck does these crazy, amazing little,
Beck's amazing,
you know, shifts of like, he can go from like a lovelorn groove to all of a sudden flip it into like some funky. It's like his songs are really exciting, within one song, you know, and over the course of a record, it's I mean, there's a reason why those guys have sustained a long and loving followers, because nobody's quite sure what they're gonna do. Another band that does that is Liars. I'm like, when Liars put out a record, I'm always like, I can't wait to figure out what you know, you put that in. I could be anything. I have no idea what's about to come out of those speakers when I put on a Liars record, and or from song to song. I think that's exciting.
There's some. I was just thinking about. Just think. There's some Beck songs that, like, you know, because it's just like he just mysteriously releases, like, all of a sudden, like, oh, there's a Beck record. What, there is? Oh, great.
Yeah.
That's there are some songs in there where it almost feels like he's daring people to put it on the radio. Where it's almost like, I fucking dare you to figure out a way to put this
right
on the radio.
Well, he did the last thing he released was Sheet Music.
Yeah, yeah,
but he was he was writing in a whole different style with the understanding that this needs to be something that people can look at and read and play. So it's his other records often he had to avoid doing some of the things that he does in the studio with all the, like, you can just like feel it weird, you know, make things sound weird and do different versions, put a million pedals on it, so the guitar sounds like nothing you've ever heard. With Sheet Music, it's like sheet music for guitar. Here it comes, you know. It's like it didn't have all the studio trickery to it, and it was important for him for the songs to work. Whoever was playing them,
just as a piece
on
of music,
whatever version, yeah, of, you know, crappy guitar or piano that they have, that the song needed to still work, and you couldn't soup it up with you know, giant plate reverb and. You know, 20 weirdo pedals and stuff. So I thought that was really, really cool. And I think that's being released by different people are recording it. I don't know, yeah. Maybe. I don't know. But so he's a really inventive in not only as a musician, but also in the way he thinks about how people, you know, listen to music and acquire music and how they think of it. I thought that was amazing. I actually have not, since I can't play the guitar, I have no idea what that record sounds like. So, that the sheet music record.
It's like you're giving you homework to listen to the song.
I need to learn to play guitar just so I can hear that Beck's last record.
So when you're in a band, was it like 13 years now, you guys?
Our band started, I think we started getting together and noodling around with song ideas in 99. So
just the beginning of when radio started to get weird, when the internet and like when it was like just the cusp of music about to change
about the like
business.
The way people found out about you and we would not. I think if we had started 5 years earlier, we probably would have died on the vine a little bit because we were. For the first 5 years of our career, we didn't have any attention at all, but we had just enough little mentions here in blog, this blog or that blog or little things that were, you know, online, you know, things sustained us and kept us from losing faith, I think. And I think bands now, and then ultimately, you know, we've become a relatively successful band without like I was saying, without a single radio hit or, we've never been on the cover of any magazines until just like this year. Really.
So you do consider yourself successful. That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, good. Because before when you were talking about like, oh, you know, sometimes they put pressure on us. Of like, you know, I hope it's just what you never want to see is when people are doing really well and they're like, nah, it's not. Like, no, come on, it's happening.
We're not. You know, we're not buying sports cars, but as far as a band goes, a bunch of people making rock songs for a living. I think, you know, I'll be able to pay my rent, and right now we're at a point where we don't have other jobs. You know, it's just this band, so we are very successful. That's I think our definition of success, that we don't have to have other jobs. Right now, we may soon, but after this interview,
but, just start shitting on everyone systematically. And here's what this guy does. And he's right.
But talking about the way the music, the way people find music and are exposed to music, our band would not be around, I think, if it hadn't happened in that atmosphere. And I think when they talk about the music industry, I do believe. I think the industry side of it has suffered a lot, which who cares? You know, it's like it's business. The business side of I don't think any musicians or music lovers care about that, you know, too much. I'm not trying to be harsh, but as far as music lovers and musicians trying to make music and find people to connect with and put it out there in a way that people can hear these songs that they're writing in their bedrooms, they don't need a major label. They don't need... all they need is a MySpace page or whatever the newest version of MySpace is. I'm not very good at that stuff, but we hire experts to deal with that. But anyway, my point is you can be a band in the shadows for a long time and slowly people can find you, or you know.
I think that's so much better than obviously if a band pops on their first album. Oh, that's fun. You know, that's fun for them. But then it doesn't give anyone. It's so much more fun to discover a back catalog. We're like, how have I never heard of this band before? Oh my God, there's like four amazing albums that I get to experience and kind of watch them evolve, as opposed to, you know, huge, like one album is huge and the next one's like, this next one better be fucking great. You know, like, well, that's, the slow build is way better.
We've had a very slow build, and not on purpose. I would have told you that at the very beginning, if we could have been the Strokes, we would have chosen that a million times over. And right now we feel very, very, you know, happy with how things happened for us. But I think there is something I discovered, like, for example, Tom Waits. I think I first heard Tom Waits when I was in college, and it was actually a Red Hot compilation, and I can't remember what song it was, but I'd never listened or heard of Tom Waits, and I hadn't been exposed to it. And I heard this song on some, I wish I remembered the name of the song, on some Red Hot compilation. And I loved it so much. I thought, this is the great. And I was convinced it was a black guy. And so I went looking for Tom Waits records. And then I went to a little indie, a little record store in Cincinnati. And the only thing I could find that was, and this little story didn't have much of Tom Waits, was a Tom Waits the early years record, and on it there's this skinny young white guy on the cover, you know, and I'm like, this isn't the same guy, you know, and I even bought the, but I brought the record, took it home, and he sounds completely different back in his early years stuff. It's like,
oh, this is Tom Waits, he's a totally different guy.
No, you're right. Exactly.
You want Tom Waits.
This is some other white guy named Tom Waits playing these like kind of songs on acoustic guitar about his sitting here in my rocking chair with my dog losing his hair or whatever. You know, it's like, that's not the same guy. And then Bone Machine, I think, came out or something. And then I started following the arc from this, his early years stuff, which or whatever that was maybe, I don't know when he put out the early years, but it was like, it's folksy, like, you know, just a guy in an old guitar, to much later when it gets into these crazy, you know, like garage, like whatever stuff is he's building instruments out of in his garage, and kooky, the stuff that's on Bone Machine, and later stuff, Frank's Wild Years and stuff, and seeing, it was such a pleasure to see how an artist evolved from these two points, you know, these two points at which I had discovered, for the, you know, his latest thing and his earliest thing, and then, you know, following all the dots in between and going back and forth between the dots in between was a really crazy exciting way to discover somebody. So if somebody, like, you know, if in 10 years from now some kid gets to college and somebody says, oh, there's this old band from 2012 or whatever, 2013, called The National, check them out, you know, then they go get our first record thinking, you know, and our first record sounds nothing, to me, sounds nothing like Trouble Will Find Me or High Violet. And I think that's, I like to think that maybe we'll be one of those kind of bands. But
are you excited about getting older in the sense of like, oh, I can't wait to see, with, you know, 10 or 20 years more wisdom, experience, emotions, sadness, happiness, like what comes out of that,
of us, yeah, what we make? Now having done it and having it been a thing that's lasted, you know, over a decade, and just see how we've evolved as people, as men, and as musicians, evolved and devolved and gone through high points and dark horrible times and stuff, and yeah, it's been an exhilarating thing, you know, the band has been an amazing, crazy, you know, maddening but exhilarating thing that I never would have dreamed of being in a rock band. I didn't learn how to play the guitar and or piano really, and so I got so lucky because of having friends that were great musicians and just being connected to them, and there was a window for me to come in and sing along because I couldn't do anything else, and so I kind of cheated my way, snuck into the business of being in a rock band, and what that turned into over the past, you know, 14 years now is I'm shocked and bewildered and grateful for, and it's been amazing. But
do you ever find that the band, that the concept of The National is sort of its own entity, and you might come up with something and you go, that's not for The National. Like, it's just a separate, like, it doesn't fit the entity.
Yeah, we all have, I mean, well, we don't, we're constantly trying to not have the entity be something like that, but where it's like, oh, that's what The National sounds like. We actually are attempting every record to sort of put completely, you know, do the, like, not walk in our own footsteps if possible. At some point, we're also like, well, a song, you know, if the song is good, that's all that matters. We don't have to try to reinvent ourselves every time. But I think it's important, like I was saying about other bands, like we mentioned earlier, but that like Beck or Radiohead, you have to keep surprising yourself, or else you will sort of wither on the vine a little bit. And so, but that being said, all of us have things. I mean, Bryce does all kinds of stuff with classical music that just, you know, maybe it's just because I have a hard, it's hard for me to sing to. It's, you know, it's too academic or something. But so he's got an outlet for that stuff. Aaron does a lot of producing and doing stuff with other musicians too and stuff. Our band has a very kind of open open philosophy about, we have an open marriage.
Oh, good.
If you want to put it that way. I have not done much outside of the National Musical.ly because I'm too sleepy.
Well, it's hard enough really to keep one band together.
Right. But I've done a lot of little things with other people and stuff like that. But I think it's good. It's healthy. It's healthy to, for us to have that release valve to, like, so it's not all the pressure on this one thing, mm-hmm. This one collaborative, crucible of the national. It gets hot in there, and we all need to, like, get out of it sometimes. So I think that's been something that's kept our band together, actually, the side projects.
By the way, Pandora, the last song was For Emma, Bon Iver. Oh. And now this one is Two Door Cinema Club.
Wow.
Which I don't...
I don't recognize the name. All
right.
That doesn't sound like us.
Not really. I want an explanation for this, Pandora.
That Two Door Cinema Club? That seems like that would be on the... Vampire Weekend.
This feels very much like a Vampire Weekend. Well, sometimes it does. I thought that was
Vampire Weekend.
I have heard this song before. Okay, so this is features on this track, Four on the Floor Beats. That's a thing. Rock influences, electronic influences, new wave influences. I think...
I've heard this song. This is a good song.
A knack for catchy hooks, it says. I think... sometimes,
well, if it's catchy hooks, it shouldn't be with us. We don't have catchy hooks.
I think sometimes Pandora will reach outside a little bit to the far edges of where it can justify to see, like, this direction. And then so you'll go, no. And then it'll go, okay, I'm sorry. Okay, back to the
I think Pandora is trying to trick Two Door Cinema Club fans into liking us by linking to us.
Well, let's see if I skip the song, what comes up next? Oh, Sufjan Stevens.
Yep.
Chicago, Illinois. Fucking great album.
See, I think a lot of it might be because we've collaborated with Justin Vernon, Bon Iver, and Sufjan, and a lot of those people. There might be liner note algorithms that are going on.
There's a literal connective tissue, yeah, as opposed to just a musical connective tissue.
Maybe, yeah.
And then your brother made this documentary, or is he?
That's one of the reasons why I haven't really had any side projects, because my brother and wife have been edited. My brother made it mostly, meaning he came on tour with us. My brother, let me back it up here. My brother is 9 years younger than me. He is a different type of person than I am. We're both equally awesome, but he's a very different version of awesome now. Anyway, he's 9 years younger, and when we were about to head out on tour for our High Violet, we needed help. Because shows were getting bigger, so I invited Tom along, and I convinced our tour manager to hire Tom as an assistant tour manager, because that's the one job that didn't have technical skills that necessary, like how to fix an amp or all this kind of stuff. It was more of, like, guest list stuff and backstage stuff and all that stuff that Tom could do. So I invited him on tour, and he came on tour. And my brother is not even an indie rock fan. He's a heavy metal guy, only heavy metal and horror movies and that kind of stuff. So he'd never been to Europe. Anyway, all these things. It was definitely a fish in the wrong kind of water. And even the job of assistant tour management was. That takes somebody who is detail oriented and like, can just, like, handle 50 small things and make sure they're all taken care of. And my brother's just not that. Either am I personally. I'm not that kind of a. I don't have that kind of a personality or organizational brain. So what happened was things kind of went badly in with him in that role of assistant tour manager. And after 8 months of touring and. Just a lot of things went badly, and he ended up getting fired. But he ended up with, he had 200 hours of footage, and he had this little camera around his neck the whole time, and he was with us everywhere in the bus and in hotel rooms, and he was filming everything, and he, digging through it all, it was some of the things that he found, which are not flattering things, and I won't tell you what happens in the movie or what kind of footage is in the movie specifically, but it's nothing what any of us expected. We thought he was going to make an innocuous little maybe a video, a silly video, or some little bits and pieces of video for our website, you know, silly backstage stuff. What ultimately he made is a very beautiful, weird, sad, funny movie that my wife helped him pull together and edit. And it's I think one of the most interesting creative things I've ever been involved in as a subject. But yeah, it's called Mistaken for Strangers, and it's amazing.
It must be kind of strange to.
It's a good title, though.
Well, especially if you, I think what's great about it is that, like, you know, someone does a documentary or a reality show or whatever, they know they're being filmed, and it's sort of like, oh, uh-huh. You're a little heightened because, like, oh, there's cameras.
Yeah.
You know, but if you don't really know that it's happening, it must be kind of weird to see yourself from a third person point of view and go, like, is that what I, oh my, what?
Well, the camera he had is about the size of a softball, and it just hung around his neck. And so it wasn't like he had a camera on his shoulders or the light or anything like that. And after a week of being on tour, he's also a very affable person and disarming person. And so he was, everybody's guard, you know, went down after about a week because that little camera was so small, and he would always kind of be fiddling with it. And you didn't know if he was actually just trying to see if he had battery juice or he was filming, you know? And so he was very sneaky with it. So everybody got really comfortable, and he got a lot of stuff that I would have said, and in fact did say, and even many of the guys in the band said, were you filming that? Don't put that in. I don't want that in there. All of that went into the movie. But ultimately what happened was, because
the best stuff.
A lot of the worst stuff was directly related to Tom and his experience of getting fired and just messy stuff. That
when he built that 12-inch stone edge instead of the 12-foot one.
When he did the what?
12-inch stone edge.
Exactly. It was that kind of stuff. I mean, like some major fuck-ups happened. And but anyways, when we saw what he was doing, he was showing a very unflattering version of himself along the way in it, that we all were like, well, if he's going to do that, it's okay that he puts this other stuff in. And it ultimately, we saw that it wasn't with the purpose of exposing anything about our band or about, you know, whatever goes on, you know, backstage or on the tour bus. It wasn't about that. It was he and my wife were putting together a story of how weird and awkward it is, this family, you know, the dynamic of sibling dynamic, of older sibling, younger sibling, of famous, you know, being in this in the shadow, just how hard it is to make something of yourself on your own, how hard it is to finish something, and how hard it is not to go down, you know, some bad paths and stuff. So he made a movie that's not about the National. It's about himself and about relationships, and it's really much more interesting than a profile of a band on tour. And I think that's why people are responding to it. It's in
Tribeca, right?
It opened the Tribeca Film Festival, and that was the first time anybody outside the band or outside this house had watched it, other than a few people that we brought in to help us watch, you know, unfinished terrible versions of it, and give us really harsh criticisms when we had some help in that. But Tribeca was the first time a big group of strangers watch it, and most of them, the vast majority of people in there had never heard of indie rock or the National, and it connected with people in a much more profound way than we ever expected. And it's people come out, people crack up, but then people are coming out wiping tears out of their eyes. And Liza Minnelli apparently was overheard saying, "Oh my God, I love that movie. I love Tom. I want to take him home."
and that's when they started dating.
That's Tom. She's now. That's what Tom is. That's what he's up to now.
She's Lucille too.
He's got a new job. No. But
the job is called Liza Minnelli.
It was crazy. From Tom, you know, he made out of all this mess. He it led him to opening Tribeca Film Festival and having lunch the next day with Robert De Niro, and he just met
the same fucking guy that got fired by the tour manager having lunch with Robert De Niro.
And he just met Michael Moore, and Michael Moore fell in love with the movie. And so it's I'm so proud of him. I'm so proud of what he and my wife pulled together. And it's and I think the whole band is no one expected this. No one expected what they made. And if we had been told what he was going to try to do, I'm sure everyone would say no way that we don't want that kind of movie made. But he didn't even know what he was making until 2 years after he was digging through hours and hours of footage, the light bulb kind of went off for Tom and my wife about this is what the movie needs to be about. And then it became about something significant.
And it made your relationship better?
It did. It did. It did on one level. He was living with us, as he still does, editing. So after he was relieved of his duties on tour, I felt so bad that I didn't want him to have to go back to Cincinnati and move back in with my parents. So when the tour ended, I said, come move in with us and just work on this movie, dig through this 200 hours of stuff and make something out of it. So the process of he and my wife used to be an editor at the New Yorker for 8 years. So she's got a good sense an amazing sense of story and
it's
arc and all that.
Pretty
kind of
good
stuff.
Credential there.
Yeah. She's the two of them became this odd couple team that pulled this movie together. But the fact that was all happening in this house, and we were also in Brooklyn for a significant part of the time, it was a sometimes toxic collaborative thing. You know, my brother's making a movie about himself and about me, and my wife's even in the process of making the movie becomes part of the movie. It's weird. It's a crazy pretzel of a movie, but it's really interesting. But our relationship, to answer your question, you're going to edit this thing, right? Because I've been talking for a while.
No edits.
Our relationship.
We're almost done, by the way.
My relationship with my brother improved significantly with regards to now we are a very different type of people, and we both respect each other on a different level as adults. Whereas I think before that, he was so much younger, and I went away to college when he was 9 years old. I was 18. He was 9 years old. He was a little kid when I went away to college, and we didn't spend, and then 20 years went by where we weren't really together much. And then he comes on tour, and we're living in the bus together, living in hotel rooms together. And
you didn't even really know each other as people then.
I mean, not as adults, but I think we both of us reverted into old roles of overbearing older brother and him as the little brother. And I think what we realize is that we are both adults, and we both have to kind of respect our differences and respect each other as just people. And just as brothers, but not older brother, little brother, you know. So
has the film been released yet, or is it just played?
It is. It's hitting all the festivals right now,
okay.
And there's going to be a theatrical release and a whole digital release and all that kind of stuff. So that's been cooking, and we're pulling all of our partnerships together, and that's been a whole weird, exciting thing to figure out. Oh, how to put a movie into the world. Just like you were talking earlier about the music industry, like right when our band started in 99, was right when everything was shifting and how people got music and how they first heard about music. That's definitely happening right now with film in terms of all the digital ways that you can release TV or film now, like Louis C.K. did it on his website, but also with, then there's movies that are all day and date. Anyways, the film industry is going through a total, reinvention. Nobody quite
just
knows.
Just like every other, all the other entertainment distribution industries.
Nobody knows how to do it right. And so we are trying to put together the dream team
but
situation.
You know, it's always going to stay the same. That fire out there.
That fire will never
be there for you.
Yeah, no, I've been filming the fire, and I'm trying to figure out how to create a web series of just my fire.
I'm not gonna lie; one of my favorite DVDs is the Holiday Fireplace DVD.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's totally like you can watch that for a while. It's a real fire, and you can watch the patterns and the way. It's like, it's you never know what's gonna happen next.
So Mistaken for Strangers is making the festival circuits. And then I also had noticed that you had did you guys work with Kristen Schaal?
We did a video with Kristen, yep.
And James Urbaniak.
We did. He was in that video, and that was made by Scott Jacobson, and he sort of partnered with John Schrader, who are both writers.
John Schrader? Tall John Schrader?
Tall John. You know Tall John.
I've known John for fucking years. John, because John's a big comedy guy. I mean, like, yeah. I've known John for years hanging out at...
He's the bear in that video. He's in the bear suit, Tall John.
Oh, my God. Why didn't I know that? Yeah, I just saw Tall John...
Actually, you can actually see his face in that video, too.
I just saw John 2 nights ago.
Well, he got... John Schrader is the one who called John Slattery and said, will you be... in this video by my favorite band, and John Slattery hadn't really heard of our band at that point, but came in, was happy to do it. So that was a blast. And in fact, John Schrader was one of the people that watched several crappy versions of Mistaken for Strangers and helped us out of the woods.
He's great.
John Schrader, great guy.
I love that guy.
No, yeah, I know.
I had no idea there was a John Schrader. I guess I should never be surprised because he's sort of at the center of this pinwheel of all these different groups of bands and actors and comedians. And
I think he's got one of these unbelievably genuine and kind and funny hearts or whatever that when people bump into him, they keep wanting to come back to him and just want to be around him more. He's nothing.
His heart is 100 pounds because he's like 7 feet tall.
he's
a tall man.
Partial just gravity. People just are.
He literally has a bigger heart than most people.
No, but he's one of the most charismatic, charming, and kind men I've ever met. And he's been very kind to our film and to our band for a long time, and has helped us out in ways that many, many ways.
Great. So Trouble Will Find Me is the album, and Mistaken for Strangers is a movie. Hopefully people will be able to see it soon. And thanks for having us in your house, by the way.
Yeah.
I like it.
Could you guys clean up?
Yeah, we'll clean up.
Actually, we're going to leave this here.
We're going to leave all the recording equipment.
You guys all took your shoes off. We don't do that here.
I prefer
it's easier to get my pants off if my shoes are off. Do you understand how that works? And then we normally tell people enjoy your burrito at the end of a podcast. But now I'll say this is going back to the old K-Rock radio days of like, and here's Exile and Vilify from the Portal 2 soundtrack. 106.7 K-Rock, K-Rock,
you can have your burrito after this song.
Have your burrito. Listen to Exile. Again, if people have not heard this song, it's going to be one of their...
It's not going to work well with a burrito, though. It's more of a... I don't know.
You could salt the burrito with your tears.
It's more of a spritzer song than a burrito. So,
I guess
anyway,
that fits. Yeah, enjoy your spritzer. All right. Thanks, man.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Hey, good to see you.
Good to see you guys.
Exile. It takes your mind. Again, exile, it takes your mind. Again, you got sucker's luck. Have you given up? Does it feel like a trial? Have you given up? glass, vilified. Don't even try, vilified.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.